You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. From the launch your online shop stage, all the way to the we just hit a million orders stage. No matter what stage you're in, Shopify's there to help you grow. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/special offer, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/special offer.
In only 2 days, you can move your career further, faster with a Harvard DCE Professional and Executive Development Program. Advance your leadership skills, craft smarter business strategies, build your network, and move your career in the right direction. You'll earn a certificate of completion, add Harvard to your CV, and become the leader you want to be. Our intensive programs are designed to fit into your busy schedule. Attend online or on the Harvard campus. Search Harvard Professional and Executive Development to learn more.
It's Monster Talk, the science show about monsters. I'm your host, Blake Smith, and I'm back from a break. I've recently changed jobs, and my new work required me to do some intensive training and certification, which I've now completed. So I'm able to record episodes again. And I think you'll enjoy this one, featuring a return guest, scientist and author, Darren Naish.
It's actually quite unlike anything we've ever seen before.
A giant, hairy creature, part ape, part man.
In Loch Ness, a 24-mile-long bottomless lake in the highlands of Scotland, it's a creature known as the Loch Ness Monster.
Monster Talk. All right, so Monster Talk's excited to welcome back Darren Naish, paleontologist and author of the popular Tetrapod Zoology blog and co-host of the Tetrapod Zoology Podcasts. TetZoo.com is where you can go to hear that, along with John Conway. The Tetrapod Zoology Podcast, which I still stubbornly maintain should be called the Tetrapodcast, is a great show. We've actually done a special where we did a co-recording. Darren's here to discuss his latest book in well over a week, Cryptozoologicon. And of course, I'm joking about that, but it is good to see that someone in the science field of the side of the house is producing content at a rate at least approaching that of Nick Redfern. So Cryptozoologicon.
Redfern must be stopped. What's the book about? Where do I start? We published a book last year called All Yesterdays, which was basically about speculation in paleontological depiction of animals, in paleo art. There's all these things that there's a traditional way of depicting something. Let's say Tyrannosaurus attacking Triceratops, familiar image. But many of the ideas that we see being perpetuated are often quite poorly founded. Often they are just speculations. And we basically said, you know, you think of all the things that living animals do that you might not have, that you wouldn't know about from the fossil record. There's so many possibilities that aren't really explored. So this book was specifically saying, here are speculations on things that we haven't really seen explored before. Now, that approach to paleontology, to the depiction of extinct animals, appeals also to our interest in cryptozoology, the study of mystery animals, because a major component of cryptozoology is speculation. I mean, you think about any ideas that people have developed about the identities of mystery creatures, the ideas they come up with explaining the evolution, the biology, the ecology of mystery creatures, they are essentially exercises in speculative zoology, speculative biology, speculations about what these animals might be and the stories behind their evolution and biology, how they might work as organisms. So this book, The Cryptozoologicon, it's led by the artwork. The idea is we took a bunch of mystery animals, a bunch of cryptids, if you want to use that term, and tried to come up with, you know, novel speculative interpretations of what they could be. And initially the idea was to accompany each beautiful illustration. John Conway and Memo Kosman are the illustrators. I can draw, but I'm not really an artist. And the idea was to just accompany each illustration with, you know, like 100 words or something. But before we knew it, we ended up with great quantities of text because we wanted to explain the speculations that we explored. And then you needed to put in a bit of background, you know, like what the creature's meant to be. And then you also needed to, I was like, hold on, well, then you also need to evaluate it. You need to say what we actually think about it. You know, where does the evidence take us with regard to the reality or otherwise of these creatures? And so we've ended up producing quite a lengthy book that's got a lot of text in it, as well as some pretty pictures.
I liked it. I mean, I've got it. I bought the digital copy. And of course, we'll put a link to that in the show notes so people can buy a tangible copy as well, though. What do you think this book offers that most cryptozoology books don't? And what's different about your book?
Yeah, what's different about it? I should say, by the way, that it's only the first of, well, definitely going to be two and maybe more in the future. And that reason is because we produce so much content that due to the on-demand publishing software, the platform that we use, there's a constraint in pricing. If we produced a really big book, it would just be hugely expensive. And we thought, no, we can't have this. So we have to split it up into two. So this is volume one. Volume two is going to come along. Most artwork that you'll find in cryptozoology books is kind of pretty tired, pretty boring. Even the great classic books that everyone's got, you know, you see the same old black and white drawings being trotted out. That's not to say there aren't some very good artists who do depict cryptozoological animals regularly. Some of them almost seem to make a living from this. But yeah, we wanted some, like, you know, brand new, innovative, pretty artwork. And that's obviously what John and Memo do. So that's new. A bunch of, like, big, pretty, attractive, colorful depictions of cryptids, obscure and well-known ones. I mean, we run the whole range in this book, from familiar mystery animals to really obscure ones. And then also, I kind of think that, well, the speculative thing. So we've tried to explore new ideas that haven't been discussed before. We do make it very clear in the book, and I hope it's clear from everything that we've said about the book and everything that other people have said about the book. It's clear that our speculations are not meant to be taken seriously. We are kind of being a bit tongue-in-cheek about some of these ideas, coming up with alternative explanations for cryptids. But that's allowed us to explore and discuss things to do with the evolutionary history of animals that isn't well known, certainly isn't well known to people who are interested in mystery animals, and isn't well known to people who are, you know, science buffs, skeptics, fans of that kind of stuff in any case, you know, everything from hominid evolution to the history of dinosaurs and other similar animals and the diversity of living animals as well. I hope there's a lot of new content there. And then also our skeptical evaluation of the creatures, I think also it's kind of ironic that we, and a complete coincidence, I should add, that we worked on this book at the same time as Daniel Loxon and Donald Prothero have their new book, Abominable Science, you know, because that's obviously come out. That's a new book that's only been out for a few months. That's obviously a scholarly, critical look at cryptozoology. Our approach is kind of similar. You know, we come from a similar place in terms of a skeptical part of the universe. And so we've kind of said similar things about, you know, if you look critically at the evidence that we have for these alleged cryptids, you know, we're honest. I would say, I always try and say, you know, we're honest skeptics. You know, you don't dismiss something. You go, where does the evidence take you? There's a few cases where we're sort of on the fence, open-ended. You can't dismiss some of these animals out of hand. We need more evidence. But there are others where I think you can reject them out of hand. There's no evidence. All the evidence is a joke. And we haven't really, what's the right way of saying it? We haven't been shy in terms of basically saying that some of the people who've written about cryptids, cryptozoology, who are regarded as, you know, big people in the field, icons of the field, in actual fact, you look at some of the work that they did, some of the stuff they've said, there are some big problems in the rigor of their work. Bernard Hoovermans is the classic example. You know, like many people interested in cryptozoology, I grew up reading his books and have a great affection for them. But this kind of idea that you encounter within the cryptozoological community, that he's some mighty scholar who was the most brilliant researcher on the planet, I'm afraid... Always try and choose my words carefully, but there are reasons to question that particular view of Hoovermans. And we've said this in the book. We've said, you know, there's he compiled this case for this given mystery animal, but, well, no, he got that wrong. No, he was like 30 years out of date on that, and no, he was clearly making a big logical error in putting this and this, putting two and five together and making six here, and that kind of stuff. So, yeah.
Yeah, Ivan Sanderson had feet of clay, too, with which they made giant penguin footprints on the beach.
I wondered what where you were going to with that. Yes, yes. And did you read the thing about he actually claimed to have seen one of the giant penguins as well?
I read that in your book today. Yeah. I had not heard that before. In fact, there's a lot of new material for me. I mean, some of the creatures you covered, I had never heard of at all. And I feel like I'm fairly well read in the field. It would be handy if you could name off the creatures that you cover. That would be...
Okay, so there's no real order to the way they're treated in the book, because some of them do seem to... Well, for example, okay, so we start with... We've got quite a lengthy introduction, which covers the general history of cryptozoology and stuff. The Row, or the Row, I don't know how you say it, but this mystery giant reptile from New Guinea, known only from a single report, which has always been regarded as a hoax, but we thought there was interesting stuff to say about it. The Candy Island Monster, pretty obscure. There's a place here in England called Essex, which has got a reputation for being, as we say in the United Kingdom, a bit of a dump. And I'm sorry to anyone from Essex who's listening. The Chupacabra, or Chupacabras, however you want to say it, Watariki, which is an alleged amphibious mammal from New Zealand. The Beast of Gévaudan, which also, I don't know how to pronounce that.
Gévaudan.
Gévaudan. Again, amazing story. Just blown away with that story. It's incredible. The Bunyip, the Zoyomaro creature. Again, yeah, everyone knows that, and most people would not really regard that as a cryptid, but again, it's an interesting thing you can say about it within the context of...
We've covered that on Monster Talk. So.
Oh, I knew that. Yes, I knew that. Yes. Mobile, which episode? I must go back.
It goes way back. It was like four, right. Like three or four. It was really early on. Yeah.
Was it? Did you talk to Glenn Cuban?
We sure did.
Oh, right. Yeah. Mobile, one of these Congolese water monsters discussed by...
The creature's so nice, they named it thrice.
What does this mean if it's got three names? Very strange. And I think this is a good moment to say that it was described... We only know about this animal thanks to Roy Mackel. And, of course, today, then if you've seen...
I did. I was very sad to see that he's allegedly passed away.
Yeah, sad news. Yeah. He haven't heard anything from him for a while, so this isn't a surprise. And there was a rumor a couple of years ago, actually, that that he was with us no more. But seems to be confirmed. So yeah. People are talking about that today. So R.I.P. Roy Mackel, Professor Roy Mackel. Long-necked seal, kelpie, dingo neck. Do you know what a dingo neck is? Would you know if you hadn't read the book?
I would not have known had I not read the book.
So what do I say? Do I say to people you have to read the book to find out?
You or should,
do
I tell yes. them what it is? Yeah, no, I think you should leave mysteries here. What?
Cadbrosaurus, fairly familiar. Tizarek. Again, pretty obscure. It's a kind of water monster, a marine thing. The Buru, the hoop snake.
By the way, I loved that you covered the hoop snake. Hoop snakes and joint snakes, my grandmother told me about growing up. And you didn't cover joint snakes, but have you heard of those?
No.
It's really interesting because I suspect it's probably a real animal. But she described it as a snake called a joint snake, and it looks like a regular snake. But when you get near it or scare it, it falls into pieces, and all the pieces wriggle. So she's describing something like a lizard tail falling off. So I thought perhaps it's just a sort of folk description of some real legless lizard, right? But the catch is in the folklore, the snake will then reassemble itself when the danger's passed.
Yeah, this is quite a common motif in stories about. It's said that if you the legend in here in the UK, we have this story of this thing called the lantern worm. I'm sure you've heard of this story. This creature that was captured in a well, and the Earl of Lambton. Now, the Earl of Lambton is said to have discarded this ugly worm into a well, and then when he came back from the Crusades or something, it had turned into a giant monster that would come out of the well and eat virgins and sheep and such, and he had to wear a special spiky suit of armor in order to kill it, and he had to make sure when he killed it that he cut it up into bits And he had to do it in a place where there was fast flowing water, because if he didn't, the bits would rejoin and the animal would be okay. And the similar thing is said if you cut snakes into bits, they're said to rejoin maybe after sunset or something.
Yeah.
But yeah, definitely heard that before. And the there's a bunch of anguid lizards, glass related to alligator lizards and slow worms, those kinds of animals. What's their common name? They're called glass snakes.
Yes, glass snakes.
In Europe, right, yeah, because they're North American ones. I can't remember. I suppose they're called glass snakes as well, are they?
They are.
But, yeah, they look snake-like, but snakes actually have really short tails. But these animals, not being snakes at all, being anguid lizards, they have really long tails, and they shed the tail as a defensive mechanism, but they don't shed the tail in one piece. It breaks up into four or five independent bits, hence the name glass lizard, because they're meant to fracture into bits. So you could imagine one of these animals looks like a snake but seems to break into bits, and those bits, you know, the tail may be, I don't know, like a third or half the length of the whole animal. So people could imagine that they were seeing a snake break into bits. So I don't know, yeah, maybe you're onto something there, maybe that's where the legend comes from. But yeah, so yeah, hoop snake, bit of a weird choice, but there you go, we went with it. Megalodon, megatooth shark, the a-hool, a giant bat-like thing.
Yeah, the a-hole. So now that you've written a chapter, would you consider yourself to be a complete a-hole expert?
Yes.
Excellent.
Well, I wouldn't, actually. But in seriousness, there was one of these TV series. What's the correct plural for series? I never know how to say it.
Oh, I don't know. I assume it's series.
Series. One of these things where people, what are they called? You know, there are a whole bunch of these TV shows where people go around the world allegedly looking for mystery beasts.
Sure.
They potter around the jungle and don't find anything.
Mystery shows.
There was an episode of one of those devoted to the a-hole, and my understanding from the literature is that there are only two or three accounts which come from Ivan Sanderson. But apparently in this documentary, they recorded a couple more. They found a few more of these sightings. But, well, to be honest, who's to say how reliable that is?
Yeah.
I mean, I would be slightly suspicious that if they went into the... We certainly know from other documentaries that they basically get people to say stuff they want.
True.
So,
true.
Yeah, so I
think
I don't
we've talked to quite a few people who were on Monster Quest, and that seemed to be they really struggled to get them to fit the narrative they had already put together, right?
Yeah. So yeah. Finally, Trinity Alps salamander. So a giant salamander from the Trinity Alps. That's California, I think, isn't it? Goat man.
Yeah, you said goat man. Was that a serious chapter or was that satire?
I had to think about it. I had to think about that. Yeah, that's good. Yeah, it was. Well, the title, that section is subtitled "Half Man, Half Goat, Half Serious." So we should have done that. Half satire, half satire. Very good.
Second
edition,
right?
Yeah, I was definitely. I love one of the stories of I'll give some details away on this particular mystery creature, but Goatman is one of these mystery creatures where different people in different parts of North America have come up with legends of, in quotes, Goatman independently. So it's not as if there's one entity that lives in Detroit or something, but it's different places have come up with their own Goatman legends, and all of which are nonsense. One of them is meant to be, the original one is meant to be like a Sasquatch type creature from, you know, somewhere in the south.
It was the Carolinas.
East.
Yeah.
That's it, somewhere like that, yeah. And then, but then there's others that are meant to be, there's one that's meant to be a laboratory experiment gone wrong. Some kind of crazy guy, a bit like the lizard in Spider-Man, you know, but a goat instead of a lizard, wears a lab coat and carries an axe, and it's very dangerous. And so we decided to run with this. What if there really was a goat man My favorite story, I think it's from Oregon, is the media said that they found the goat man.
I remember that very well, right?
The goat man was being filmed from a helicopter, and it turned out to be a guy disguised as a goat because he was training for hunting mountain goats. But they called him the goat man, so it became somehow involved in the goat man saga.
I thought the subtext of the goat man legend was that goats are very promiscuous. That's what I always assumed that was the implication, that somewhere there was a lonely farmer and a very open-minded goat. So
a goat-human hybrid. We didn't cover that hypothesis.
Well, this is interesting, though, because a lot of cryptozoology, the creature components themselves, come from eyewitnesses' accounts or legends and not from physical samples. I mean, obviously, the washed up on the shore dead animals are the exception to that. But because of that, the speculation about what these creatures might be from the cryptozoology side is not as informed as what you have in this book. This the speculation portion of each chapter, I thought, this is really the first opportunity to get a even though some of them are quite amusing and silly, you do take a very reality-based approach to your speculation, I think.
Yeah, well, I'm pleased to hear you say it. Thank you very much. But yeah, there's a couple of things you could say about that. One is that I think that some of the ideas that have kind of become mainstream in the cryptozoological literature, you see them being repeated again and again and again, is they're quite tired and boring. You see the same ideas being repeated again and again and again. So that Congolese creature discussed by Roy Mackle, the Mabilu Mabilu Mabilu, he comes up with a suggestion in his 1987 book, A Living Dinosaur. He says that, so the Mabilu Mabilu Mabilu, supposedly two people described how they saw a water creature with planks on its back. And he immediately came up with the idea of it being like a stegosaur type animal. And then we see that idea being repeated again and again and again in all the cryptozoology books, as if that's the only thing people can think of. And it's, come on, if you're going to come up with an alternative explanation for that phenomenon, there's a whole list of other things you've got to consider. And as you'll know, I think you and I spoke about this before when we did a podcast, the Tetrapodology podcast, but there's other things you can come up with that are better in some ways, you know, better explanations than the one we keep seeing repeated again and again and again. I think part of the problem with some of these ideas in cryptozoology is that most people who produce cryptozoological literature, now again, I'm going to try and be careful how I say this, but because, putting this in the wrong order, but here I go. Yeah, cryptozoology has always involved, you know, people that are qualified scientists. You know, there's lots of people who are tremendously knowledgeable about zoology and biology and the diversity of animals. Lots of those people are involved in cryptozoology. However, many other people who produce cryptozoological books are not, trained. They're not zoological experts. They don't necessarily know that much about animals. I'm not saying there's anything wrong with that.
Let me interject here. Let me remind people that Brian Regal described it as a split between crackpots and eggheads. And then we'll put the blame there and you can move forward.
Okay, Brian, as Brian said, he is solely responsible, yeah, for this view. But I think because there's so much of an overlap between cryptozoology and sociology, psychology, anthropology, all these other fields, I can understand why some of the most prolific cryptozoological authors aren't really coming to the subject from the zoological perspective. They're coming at it from the human interest angle. And so that means there often isn't a zoological expertise displayed in people's speculations and evaluation of cases. And people are often, you know, not aware of what's been said about animals in the technical literature. They're not aware of, you know, ideas about evolution and all that kind of stuff, which, you know, I think in an approach to cryptozoology, we need to follow, we should follow what Hoovermans said. He was a qualified zoologist, and he said that, it was meant to be part of the zoological sciences. And, I mean, there is a big problem in this view in that it kind of assumes to start with that cryptids are flesh and blood animals. That itself is a big problem with the whole area. But you're supposed to be interpreting these things within a zoological framework. So you've got to have like the biology and evolution smarts in the first place. And yeah, we're often not seeing that. So we've tried in the book to incorporate that stuff as much as possible, often incorporating totally new ways of looking at creatures. So the A-hole, that giant bat-like thing, yeah, when people write about it, when cryptozoologists write about it, they say, ooh, it's a giant bat and it could be the biggest bat ever. But they don't say, well, there's these new ideas on bat evolution, which suggests that there's this weird group of bats that might conceivably possess a bunch of features that do seem consistent with what you see in the A-hole. You don't see that in the cryptozoology literature because the cryptozoologists tend not to know about it. So some of these ideas that we explore in the book, yeah, they are novel. They are informed by new stuff that we know about because it's, you know, I'm a working paleozoologist. I publish technical stuff about fossil and living animals, and John and Memo are both specialist technical artists who keep up to date with this stuff as well. So I think we're one of my big problems with the cryptozoology literature has always been that most of the a lot of the ideas in it are just not coming from a properly informed source, and they're decades out of date. And this was true of Bernard Hoovermans himself. I mean, he was saying stuff when he was writing his books in the 50s. He was saying stuff in the 50s that was known to be wrong in the 1930s. So it's like, come on, he was not very, very few of us can be up to date on, you know, an area as vast as animals, the living world. You know, can you really keep up with absolutely everything? That's really, really hard. And to be trained in, you know, most of us are trained in one small thing, and then to say bold, brave things about some area of expertise that's long away, far away from your actual area of expertise can be dangerous. It can get you into trouble, and this definitely has happened.
An unwarranted confidence in one's intelligence is and skills can lead to all kinds of interesting and horrible conclusions in your career.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I just keep telling people how stupid I am and that I know what. Well,
humility and self-deprecation are good qualities, or at least I believe they are. Let me ask this. So why do you think it is that so few technically grounded people in your field maintain that sense of wonder about monsters? Do you ever sit around with paleontologists and talk about this sort of thing?
Yeah, definitely. It's quite a popular area, as is an interest in monsters from sci-fi movies and comic books and stuff.
So the idea that scientists don't do that sort of thing is actually just a bad stereotype?
Until you've just told me about it, I wasn't aware that this was a stereotype.
Oh, yeah, you haven't read on the cryptozoology blogs about how scientists living in their ivory towers of academia, they dismiss all things wonderful, and you've never noticed, you've never run into that trope, seriously? Oh, my God.
The human experience is... It's complicated. It's difficult to generalize about people.
Yeah, well, I say scientists. I mean, monster denialists. What?
Yeah. but because on the one hand, I could say I know a load of, scientists who are, with all due respect, they might be very nice people, but they're actually very boring. They're not interested in anything that overlaps with like my mother. My mother's approach, she would say, what are you interested in, that rubbish? I don't want to watch Aliens or Terminator. Well, that's rubbish. Turn it off. I want to watch Coronation Street or Emmerdale Farm or the news or something. Sorry, those references might have been over your head, but references are going to be boring British soap operas.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
I'm Jane Perlez, longtime foreign correspondent and former Beijing bureau chief for The New York Times. I've been a foreign correspondent in lots of places, Somalia, Indonesia, Pakistan, but nowhere as important to the world as China.
I mean, China is not dropping anti-democratic paratroopers into Montana. But of course, we did see things like the weather balloon / spy balloon riveting the whole country for a week.
This is Face Off, an 8-part series in which we'll take you behind the scenes to key moments in the tumultuous U.S.-China relationship. We'll speak with a diplomat, a spy, a tech reporter, a U.S. admiral, even Yo-Yo Ma. Plus, my pal and noted China historian Rana Mitter joins the conversation. We'll look at what's driving the two nations apart and explore whether anything can help bring them back together. Face-Off launches April 9th.
There is that kind of attitude, yeah, in like, oh, some scientists want to be serious and they're fairly straight people. They don't have an interest in this kind of stuff. But I would say the majority, I think, of people I know who are, you know, passionate and interested about this stuff. I mean, I think of how many scientists I know that went to see Jurassic Park or Godzilla or are excited about the new Godzilla movie, you know, that kind of thing. We're talking about a significant percentage of people. There's always been a big interest in speculative evolution. All the ideas about possible alternative trajectories of evolution and possible animals in the future and what about the things we don't know about from the past. I would say that's a big draw. And there is so much overlap between that kind of interest and the interest in mystery animals. So so far as I'm concerned, this is kind of like a major part of not something we think about on an hourly basis because, you know, working very hard, but yeah, certainly something people talk about when they're having a beer. And I'm not familiar with the stereotype that that scientists in general are not interested in this stuff. And I'm thinking about Charles Paxton, who I know quite well. He's technically a fisheries ecologist, works on statistics of how fisheries work, which, sorry, Charles, but incredibly boring, you know, really sort of dry statistics-based stuff. But when he talks to you about his interest in all of our ideas about monsters and cryptozoology and speculations about animals that might exist, you know, he says that an interest in talking about, you know, people's ideas about monsters is something really important and really kind of, you know, basic to the whole scientific drive, because you're telling people you're actually considering an area that's basically to do with wonder of the unknown, like a fascination in sort of, you know, things that might be, what stuff that's really exciting, no matter how, where you are on the science scale, whether you're like a statistician or whether you're someone with just a casual interest. It's important. It's something that like incites wonder and makes us think, and speculative evolution, any ideas related to speculation and evolution are important, because they do lead us to ask questions about the real world. You know, when in doing this book, The Cryptozoologicon, John Memo and myself, we've said that some of these cryptozoological creatures, we can be pretty confident that they don't really exist, and there are good reasons why they don't exist. But in so why don't they exist? Well, that's not just a hunch. That's kind of, there's a good idea why, you know, a certain, why there probably aren't, you know, 600-foot long giant serpents off the coast of New England. You know, there's probably a good reason why that isn't the case, and you can come up with a set of specific questions and answers as to why that isn't, why that is or is not the case. Do you see what I mean? It leads you to ask valid questions about the way the world works and about biology, yeah, and about evolution. Yeah.
So that was somewhat of a forced question, because I mean, as a I just happen to know for a fact that many of our listeners are teachers or working scientists, and they still listen and we talk about monsters. So I know it's not true, but I keep encountering it on all kinds of cryptozoology message boards. It just seems to be a recurring stereotype. And it's like, it's the idea that science rejects things that aren't new. But everything I've seen from working scientists is they're looking for things that would overturn a paradigm. They're looking for things that are new and wonderful and different.
I would say this is, I don't know how understood, how appreciated it is outside of the the academic community, and I mean academic community in the broadest possible sense, you know, including everyone who's interested in anything to do with that you call academic, but how I don't really appreciate how well known it is outside that bunch of people, that when you're inside it, particularly if you're like a, if you're a researcher like myself, or if you're, you know, a professor, or if you're involved in anything to do with research, what are you hoping to find? What is the point of what you do? And in a nutshell, the idea is, well, we're looking for the next big thing, the big thing that changes everything. So, and we're all, I kind of compared it to what I call Lego bricks. I think you call them Legos, don't you?
That's
Legos.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Science is like a giant, grandiose Lego structure. And over time, thousands and thousands, tens of thousands, if not millions of individual people have added little bricks to this giant structure. And if you're, you know, a lucky scientist in your career, you'll get to add like a few little bricks to one of the buttresses of one of the sidewalls. You know, you'll make a tiny contribution that will be minuscule on the scale of things. But what people want to do is they want to actually smash down a whole wall or smash down half the structure and like rebuild it. It's like people want to, how do we come up with these, well, we call them informally, a group of researchers I'm involved in, we call them game changers. Like, oh, I've got a real game changer idea here. You want the next big thing? So of course people are taking seriously the possibility that, you know, hey, if Sasquatch does exist, well, we're damn well got to say something about it. We're going to do something about it if we do find some compelling, gee whiz, game changer data. Or, oh my God, that sea serpent carcass isn't a rotting shark. It actually is a sea serpent carcass. So I don't need to tell you this. I don't need to tell your listeners this. But the general idea that scientists are kind of sitting on things, keeping them quiet. I mean, I heard a claim a couple of months ago that some people involved in tiger conservation in Sumatra had a body of orang pendek and they were keeping it quiet. And I was like, excuse me, you're talking about people who are involved in the conservation of an area that basically is being razed to the ground for the palm oil industry or something. Do you not think that if they actually had something as game changery, as significant as the body of a new hominid, don't you think they would do something about that immediately? They wouldn't sit on it at all. They would rush into print with something like that. So yeah, so many stereotypes about the way science works, and there's a whole list of things, you know. Don't get me started, but
No. Well, I wanted to get you started. Thank you for sharing all that. So.
Okay. So first of all, the game changer concept. So any ideas about conspiracies of silence, people sitting on data? Absolute rubbish. That is not how, there are no conspiracies in science. That's not how it works. And one reason that it doesn't work, and I may be repeating myself here, is basically because the nature of science is pretty brutal. It's red in tooth and claw. It's people like trying to, you know, get one over on colleagues and be the one who gives the best talk at the international conference and be the one who gets the big paper, all that kind of stuff. So it's very driven. I mean, science is about people. Yes, it's all about getting bits of evidence together and coming up with conclusions based on the evidence. And you have to be able to, any statement you make obviously has to be backed up by data. That's a given, you know. That is the basic premise of science. That's what makes it different from other areas of the human experience, like religion, for example. So, if people have new data, they're going to act on it. They want to act on it. So any ideas about conspiracies of science sitting on data, absolutely ridiculous. This is about people trying to do well for themselves, trying to do well for their research groups, blah, 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 blah. That kind of leads us to money. So the idea, first of all, that scientists are Scrooge McDuck, vast caverns of wealth sitting around on their huge, sitting on their enormous piles of cash, vast sums of money. Waste away their money on some frivolous bit of research. Excuse me, what planet, anyone who says that, what planet are you living on? Do you not realize how low scientists' wages are? They're not paid as poorly as people that work at, you know, McDonald's or KFC or something, but they are, there is not money in science. Do not go into science if you are financially driven. I know what I'm talking about here. So, and grant money, I mean, the situation at the moment, the economic crisis is particularly bad at the moment. But
for our
ordinarily,
listeners, Darren's new series on Don't Go Into Science, Motivational Speaking. His lecture series, the next TED Talk.
yeah, maybe. I can see a thing in that, yes. I wouldn't make any money from it, though. So,
so why not?
I might do it anyway. I'm not financially, nothing I do is related to money whatsoever. But no, just the idea that there's any financial motivation in science. I mean, don't get me wrong, of course there are rich scientists, and of course there are lots of people in science who've gotten into science because they have a fairly easy life.
Yeah,
money
but
to start with.
There may be rich scientists, but they didn't get rich by doing science.
No. Right. Yeah, there's literally one or two people who, have been very lucky. But yes, absolutely. So,
but it's so rewarding to find things out.
Yeah, and
your family.
Yeah. Let's not go there. But maybe let's pretend this is a third point. Then the fact that what motivates us to do science, to come up with new stuff, to announce to research the things we do. Well, partly we do deliberately find sexy things that we think we can get grant money for, and I don't know if people know, but the rate of success for grants is somewhere, I think it's like 8% success rate or something ridiculous.
So you buy a lottery ticket every time you do a grant proposal.
And you're probably more likely to win. Yeah. It's just crazy. I did get a successful grant application in this year, but the money has yet to materialize. So it's, and we're not talking about a lot of money anyway. We're talking about enough to cover a few research trips and stuff. But what motivates us to do stuff? I mean, yeah, we're trying to come up with attractive things that we know will make people think, oh, that's something I should potentially fund. But by and large, it's kind of, you know, genuine passion and curiosity. I mean, most of the stuff that I work on, most of the stuff that the people I know work on, they work on it because they're really interested in it, because they honestly want to know. And there's a there's like a genuine conscientiousness, a real kind of sense of loyalty to some. I should say I'm only talking about people working in the biological sciences here. There's, you know, people who study frogs, let's say, love frogs. And they're not working on frogs because they know that frogs are going to make them rich. In fact, the opposite is going to happen. Frogs are going to make them penniless. They're going to die alone. but they will do all they can to help the frogs. And I, you know, that's true. So, you know, if you're passionate about frogs, it's like, well, how many questions are there to ask about the way the froggy world works? You know, lots of people currently, okay, talking about frogs, lots of people are putting a lot of time and effort into working out the, exactly what's going on, the link with climate change and habitat modification to do with Batrachia choridium dendrobatidis, this killer fungus that's basically wiping out amphibians throughout the tropics, the world, particularly in the American tropics. BD it's called. So a lot of people, you know, you can understand people asking questions about that thing, not because they're thinking of money, not because there's some conspiracy they're trying to suppress, no, because they're honestly, genuinely passionate about this subject. And I've got a feeling I've gone off on a massive tangent here.
No problem. No, actually, this all I could tie it back together, thusly. So in addition to the financial benefits of this book, there must be other reasons to buy it as well. So I know, you know, as a working scientist, you also need money. So that listeners should please give now. The number is on the screen. but also, there's this beautiful artwork in the book. Can you talk about the artwork just a little bit?
Yeah. So John and Memo, John Conway, Memo Kosman, CM Kosman. So for all the cryptids in the book, what is it? I think it's 28 beautiful full size color full page, not full size, but novel color restorations of these animals. So everything ranging from Bigfoot to Tizarek and all these various cryptids. Novel, beautiful artwork. And both of them do stuff that's been quite praised by people who come from an arty bent as well as a scientific bent, because it's I can tell you that John's style often recalls things like sort of oriental watercolors and kind of French Renaissance art and all styles that are kind of unfamiliar looking styles, which I think just means they look novel wonderful and interesting. So plus, of course, they are depicting animals as if they're biologically plausible, genuine organisms. So anyone who likes looking at, gets an art fix, looks for an art fix in a book, will really enjoy this. Anyone who's seen All Yesterday's, our previous book on speculation in paleontology, will get a kick out of this. And I think anyone who knows the cryptozoological literature, that knows something about the creatures, will enjoy this. So yeah, the look of it, I love their stuff. Absolutely love their stuff. I mean, if I wasn't involved in it, yeah, I would just be nuts about this book. And like I say, it's kind of meant to be picture led. The book is meant to be about the artwork, with the text being secondary. But we ended up with, like I said, a bit more text than originally planned. But
I think that's to the benefit of the book. Honestly, it's really good. One more question about the content. So in your, I don't want to spoil it, but in your Chupacabra chapter, you describe the Chupacabra in your speculative portion as being a marsupial, which I thought was pretty interesting. And the binomial nomenclature you gave for it was, if I'm reading this right, Deinorhoe caprophagus. Is that?
Yeah.
Okay. And so I was, you didn't explain that. I'm guessing that's a joke.
It's not that funny. It's going to be a bit of a disappointment. But we came up with scientific names for all the animals that are meant to be, you know, plausible scientific names that we would give to these things if they really were real. And we came up with this idea. John actually wanted the Chupacabra. Incidentally, there's a mistake in the Chupacabra section. We originally had both spellings, Chupacabra ending in A and Chupacabra ending in RAS. And I said, can you make sure that you, it was like a last minute edit. I said, can you make sure you replace one of the versions? And someone did change all throughout the document. So we actually have a bit where it says the Chupacabra, also called the Chupacabra, and those are both the same spellings, which I find quite annoying. But John wanted it to be a giant bipedal marsupial. And at the time, because he did the artwork first and we did the text later. And while we were doing this, there was a paper published, and I can't remember all the details, so you have to excuse me, but it was saying that there's a living, when we say opossum, most people think of the Virginia opossum, the big whitey gray one that you'll know very well, being in America.
Roadside everywhere.
Exactly, yeah. You may or may not know that there's actually quite a few of them are really horrendously aggressive, well-armed uber predators, despite the fact that they're the size of a mouse or a rat. And there was a paper published on one of these South American ones saying that this opossum, like 15 centimeters long or so, is basically a saber-toothed predator, sort of, you know, similar to like a saber-toothed cat, but it's the size of your hand. And so we had a bit of fun with that. We thought, well, let's have like a super-sized killer opossum. Because obviously, you know, the Chupacabras, we know it's got big stabby teeth of some kind. So Deinorhoe, that merely means a terrible kangaroo type thing.
Okay, because so the roo part was right. Okay, got it.
Yeah. Dino, as in dinosaur, means terrible, but it doesn't mean terrible as in really bad. It means terrible as in awesome. So people say dinosaur means terrible lizard. It doesn't mean terrible as in they weren't very good. it means awesome, like really super. Yeah, oftentimes when people use it in a scientific name, they contract it a little bit. So when Richard Owen in the 1840s came up with wanted to name a bunch of reptiles dinosaurs, he contracted dinos into dino, D-I-N-O, but it's the same meaning. And then the, yes, you're right, the specific name, caprophagus, specifically means goat eating, which is a bit silly. But, you know, if the Chupacabra was a real animal, and if it really was a giant predatory bipedal nocturnal opossum, then maybe that's the name we would give it, Deinorhoe caprophagus. So, and many of the scientific names are kind of, you know, references, sort of jokes along those lines. But then there are other creatures in the book where we actually haven't had to do much speculation, if any speculation, because, you know, if you use what's in the literature, well, people have done a pretty good job. You can't, what can you say about Sasquatch, Bigfoot or the Yeti that isn't already in the books? I mean, you think of how many books there are on Bigfoot. It's hard. You'd be really difficult. You couldn't come up with some explanation for Bigfoot that says it's not a giant bipedal striding hominid, right? If you came up with any alternative,
that would be ridiculous, right? I also just found Stupendaconda was a good one too.
Oh, good. I'm glad you like that one. I really enjoyed. Now, that was another one where quite a few of the speculative explanations were inspired very much by, sometimes by things that cryptozoologists have said, but sometimes by the things that skeptics of cryptozoology have said. So Stupendaconda, and again, to get the full details, you have to read the book. But Stupendaconda is basically our gigantic Amazonian anaconda. So most people are familiar with stories. The best known one is the Colonel Percy Fawcett one, right, where he reported seeing and shooting an anaconda that was, I've forgotten the size, but it was ridiculous. It was, you know, many, many times bigger than...
Yeah, I want to say it was, good grief. Was it 60 feet long? It was something crazy like that, you know.
I think you're right. I think it's about that kind of size. I'm going to cheat and look at the book while I talk to you. But one of the, and I do know cryptozoological researchers who honestly think that they really are, that this really exists, that they really are supersized Amazonian snakes that are many times bigger than the largest recorded anacondas and reticulated pythons.
And since this is a radio show, I'll just tell you that Darren is right now flipping through a beautiful copy of his book, looking for the reference. So
19 meters long. Yeah.
Well, so then I was pretty close. Yay.
And he said that he saw others, or he saw evidence for others that must have been, quote, altogether dwarfed by the one that he that would have altogether dwarfed the one that he shot. So he claimed there were even bigger ones. So one of the things that I've heard from herpetologists, professional herpetologists, who regard this stuff as just, you know, tall tales, just ridiculous, they say that, well, if there really was some kind of giant kind of anaconda that could grow this large and yet was different from the known anacondas, how come we don't have any juveniles or babies of them? Because, of course, people have collected, wow, millions of anacondas for the skin trade and as museum specimens as well. So if there's another kind of anaconda that gets to ridiculous size, approaching 20 meters and more, you'd have baby ones of them. So, well, we can get around this. We can say, well, haha, maybe there aren't baby ones because the adults are so big. They actually produce viviparity, the ability to give birth to live babies, is the norm in these kinds of snakes in boas. So if you have a supersized species, what about the idea that it just gives birth to one like supersized baby, which when it's born is already bigger than the biggest officially recognized snake? So we had fun with ideas like that. So it's informed by genuine things that cryptozoologists and skeptics of cryptozoology have said, and it's informed by stuff that's been published on the biology and evolution of the animals concerned. And, you know, we cite references and everything, and there's some discussion in that section on Stupendaconda on, work by Jason Head, who you know very well, this work on these gigantic fossil snakes from Colombia. This stuff on the reproductive biology of living snakes, which is relevant to our hypothesis. So I would say it's kind of like, you know, informed speculative fiction.
I loved it. I think the listeners will love it too. So I think I will do everything to get this episode out this week. So because there's a turnaround time on ordering. So if you get the ebook, you can get it instantly. But if you get you want the paper copy, there's going to be some lead time there. You're going to need, if you were the kind of person who would want to gift this to someone who loved monsters or yourself, you need to act fast. So link will be in the show notes.
Great, yeah. Yeah, I'm really happy so far with all the feedback we've got. I mean, brilliant stuff from thank you to, you know, Sharon Hill did a brilliant review the other day, and Cameron McCormick, really nice review, and quite a few nice things online. But so far, there's a deafening silence from some of our true believer cryptozoology colleagues, and I don't think they like it. I think they're...
It's hard to tell. Daniel and Don's book... it took a little while for the cryptozoology believer side to sort of chime in. And it was, Don kind of predicted how that would go, and Daniel didn't think it would go quite as negatively. But it, yeah, Don, I think, won that bet.
So, yeah, the interesting story behind that. I've been following that as well.
Yeah,
so. And I love that book. Very impressed with it. I think it's a brilliant. I've said this. I think it's quite possibly the most important book on cryptozoology, which did make some people quite cross.
Yeah.
Yeah, in terms of like its level of scholarship and how glossy, oh, shiny pages.
Oh, yeah, beautiful. Exactly. Yeah. Beautiful book.
But don't buy that. I'm buying the Cryptozoological one because it's
no. And you, I love the way you put your notes right at the end of each chapter. So Don and Daniel decided to put theirs at the end into this giant note section.
I would have two parts of the book open because I was always flipping back, checking the references. They did a very thorough job there, but very nice book. Really impressed with it.
So, but you did great notes too, and I love the artwork. And I think again, I think listeners will really enjoy this. And I appreciate your time. I guess I should ask you again, what's your favorite monster? Because it might have changed. Looking around the room. Darren's looking around the room, looking for.
trying to think of one. Well, I don't know. I can't really think of a Pacific Rim.
What's your favorite kaiju?
My favorite kaiju is probably. I'm rusty on all this stuff because I haven't seen it for a while. I can't remember their names. Knifehead. I thought he was pretty cool.
Yeah.
Is that his real name? What's his real name?
Oh, I don't.
Itachi was. I quite liked Itachi. That was the flying one that turned out to be pregnant. I thought it was quite.
Spoilers.
Quite an interesting animal. Sorry. What about you?
Well, I like Gypsy. You know, I'm still, you know, it's funny because my favorite kaiju is probably still Godzilla. And my favorite Godzilla movie is still Godzilla versus Mechagodzilla, the first one. I loved it because they had the aliens and then there's the whole scene where Godzilla's fighting Anguirus and you're kind of confused, why is Godzilla fighting Anguirus? I thought they had become friends, and then you find out it's not really Godzilla. You know, that was a spoiler. That's a real spoiler.
That's a spoiler. I haven't seen that one. No, I'm kidding. I quite like some of the newer ones. The fact that they tried to, you know, they developed increasingly complex plots. And
well, they did. Right, they did. Yeah. And even up to Destroy... what's the big one? The Final Wars. Yeah, I like that.
Final Wars.
Yeah, the effects were a little hokey, but... this is Blake. I lost a little bit of the audio here. Darren and I continued discussing Godzilla, and then... conversation turns to the new Godzilla film, which is coming out in 2014, which we will pick up in progress now.
there's bits we see children getting evacuated and stuff. This isn't a Godzilla movie. Come on, where's the first teaser trailer? Oh my god, that was epic.
I believe that had to be a deliberate attempt to what do they call that?
Streisanding.
Yeah, well, Streisanding and creating artificial scarcity, you know. See it you can, you know. So.
Yeah. Well, that's it, because it's still quite hard to find online, to my knowledge.
And I really, you know, that was a very beautiful trailer. My son, who is obsessed with Godzilla, has been looking forward to this movie for 2 years now, because it was going to be out this year, and then they postponed it till next year.
Oh, really?
Yeah. And so... you know, it's one of those things. It's Legendary Pictures, so I mean, they're very competent with their digital effects. But if you go back to the original Godzilla, you know, it's got this, not the one with Raymond Burr, but I mean the actual original Godzilla, Gojira. It's got a really nice love story in it, and it's very tragic. But there's also a lot more about the impact on the individual people walking around, you know, you sort of feel more about the disaster. It's very obvious people are dying as Godzilla makes his way through the city. Whereas in the later ones, it seems like they evacuate and everything's clear. You don't see that many cars driving around unless it's military vehicles. And let me just make one more complaint about those movies. You kind of like wonder, as the movies go on and they make clear it's a timeline of Godzilla attacking again and again and again. It's like, wouldn't somebody try to vote in a politician who would bring in a different strategy than the same damn missiles and tanks? It's like, we already know those don't work from that last time. Don't you remember, General?
Wouldn't we have a giant wall around Tokyo or something? Yeah,
something.
But yeah, it's good. It's a good point. It's a valid point. Yeah, but whether there is continuity from one movie to the next, I don't know. Maybe it's parallel timelines and different universes. But it's a valid point. But
I do enjoy
them. Yeah.
I do. I love me a good monster movie. So, all right.
Well, yes.
Darren, thank you for spending some time with Monster Talk. I appreciate it.
Well, thank you very much. I enjoyed it. Thanks a lot.
Monster Talk.
You've been listening to Monster Talk, the science show about monsters. I'm your host, Blake Smith. In today's episode, you heard scientist and author Darren Naish talk about the mysterious animals called cryptids and about his new book, along with John Conway and Mimo Kozman, Cryptozoologicon. A link to the book is in the show notes. Darren Naish also blogs for Scientific American and is a podcaster. A link to his blog and podcasts are in the show notes as well. Monster Talk is an official podcast of Skeptic Magazine. But I must warn you, the opinions expressed on this show are those of my guests and myself and do not necessarily reflect the opinions of Skeptic Magazine or the Skeptic Society. Would you like to know about the official opinions of Skeptic Magazine and the Skeptic Society? You would? Are you sure? Well, if you would, here's how you can do this. Hey, don't try this if you're driving, but when you're able to access the internet without risking your life or the life of others, do an internet search on your Yahoo or your Bing or your AltaVista for these three magic words: Skeptic, Magazine, App. With the tools you'll find there, you can unlock the mysterious official opinions of Skeptic Magazine. Thanks to the contributors who've continued to support this show despite my erratic release schedule. If you'd like to contribute to our ongoing efforts to get transcripts for every episode, go to monstertalk.org and click the donate button. It's way down at the bottom of the page, so keep scrolling. Come join the Monster Talk Facebook group, where you'll get updates on upcoming shows and be able to interact with other fans of the monstrous, fantastic, and scientific. Monster Talk theme music is by Peach Stealing Monkeys.
That you can now subscribe to Skeptic Magazine digitally? Just grab our free Skeptic Magazine app, currently compatible with iOS, Android, PC, Mac, Kindle Fire, Kindle Fire HD, and BlackBerry Playbook. Head over to skeptic.com/magazine/app to find out more, and download more of your favorite Skeptic content.